The emerging scientific field called social genomics aims to put an end to the nature versus nurture debate, instead arguing the two coexist and influence each other through a person's lifetime.
Put it another way, our genes by themselves aren't enough to explain the course of our lives, and what happens, our environment also plays a part.
Researchers from around the world are meeting at UW-Madison this week to talk about advancements in the field of social genomics and some of the ethical issues in genetic predictions.
We've gathered a roundtable of UW-Madison professors and the La Follette School of Public Affairs to explain their work in social genomics and how it affects society. Sylvia Elena Barcelos, Lauren Schmitz, and Jason Fletcher join us now. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Kate.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Lauren, when I think about this field, I'm kind of blown away by how it blends so many different disciplines. You've got the health sciences, the psychology, the biostatistics, the human genome. What are the challenges for researchers in collaborating with scientists from such different backgrounds and figuring out what to study and why?
That's such a great question, Kate, and it is a challenge. I think when we're bringing together social data with molecular data, we really have to do team science. So and what's been partially so great about this initiative is that we've been able to bring together biostatisticians, health economists, psychologists, sociologists, et cetera, to really bring our knowledge together and our expertise together to talk about the best way to model these interactions and how they affect health. And a big thing that has allowed us to do that is it has become cheaper and cheaper in some of these larger population health studies that are kind of our bread and butter as health economists to start to collect genomic data on individuals as well as other molecular data that can help us really understand what's going on inside the cell and how that might be interacting with social forces.
What is your contribution in this space? What do you bring to it?
Yeah, so I've been fascinated by gene-environment interaction. I've done some work in that area. And then more and more, I'm doing work with epigenetics. In that discipline, there's been some really interesting biomarkers of aging, of biological aging, that have come out. So these are able to tell us, we can take a blood test from somebody and we can tell them what their biological age is. And then we can see whether they're aging faster or slower than their chronological age, which is something that has long been a quest in the field of gerontology. If we can identify who's aging faster than their chronological age, we can also link that to other factors across their life course that might be contributing to that, which then, of course, helps with interventions at the policy level and at the clinical level. So I've been doing a lot of work linking these biological factors of aging with social experiences across the life course.
And Sylvia, when you look at this field, it was called emerging 10 years ago. How do you view it as to where social genomics is going and what your contribution is to it?
Sure. Hi, Kate. It's a very exciting field right now. The explosion of data that Lauren referred to. It's been just 10 years ago that, you mentioned you kind of started, but we've learned so much, in part because we didn't have the data and the tools before we had, decoded the human DNA to do that kind of research. So it's really like this links of data, the wealth of data. We have now data in some European countries where we have genetic data linked to health registries, to tax registries, to longitudinal data on people's economic and health lives. And it's just a very exciting time to the field because this explosion of data, explosion of methods really allows us to do so much and to learn so much about this intersections across these disciplines. In terms of my contribution to the field, I'm also a health economist, so I'm interested in determinants of health and SES and how this interact. And I'm really excited right now into kind of bringing my training as an economist in causal methods and linking that to the genetic data and the, you know, links with administrative data, and really understand how genetics and, you know, interacted with the environment shapes people's lives. So I think that's the most exciting thing for me.
But with big data and using, you know, huge amounts of data and computing power to uncover, you know, genetic contributions to social traits, there's also this fear, right, that policies could be shaped about how you are, like your life insurance policy and your risk for having a heart attack. You could pay higher premiums. How do you look at the field in those respects with privacy?
So I can try to answer that. I think it's a very, very interesting question you're posing, and one that is already happening, right? I think the data is out there. People are taking more and more this direct-to-consumer tests. And it is important to kind of think about how policy and regulation should react to ensure that, you know, insurance markets, as you mentioned, are working properly with this data. You know, it's not only the case of privacy and the worry about the dangers to consumers, but also the dangers to the insurance markets as a whole. So there are a lot of different lenses that needs to be studied, and with important policy and regulation implications that is part of the work we are interested in doing.
What do you make of it, Jason? Will biologically informed policies become more acceptable, more mainstream in the future?
You're right in describing how controversial this question is. And the U.S. has some protections, as you know, around health insurers not discriminating against individuals' genetics and employers not discriminating against people based on their genetics. But those laws could be expanded. And that's something that our group really thinks about, both the pros and the cons. And other countries are considering more stringent standards about in what cases individuals can act on their genetic information, or other units in society can act on individuals' genetic information. So it's a very emerging field. And I think this is an example of the promise of having many disciplines examining a field like this. There would be many, many lenses to examine this question. That's an advantage of our group and other groups around the country.
We're talking about the future of social genomics with three UW-Madison professors, Jason Fletcher there. We have Sylvia Elena Barcelos and Lauren Schmitz with us. Lauren, later this month, UW-Madison hosting the Advances in Social Genomics Conference for researchers from around the world. What do you hope to gain from the conference?
Well, given that this is such a new and exciting field, I think there are not always a lot of opportunities for us to come together, the scientists that are interested in this type of work. So I think it's always a wonderful time to bring interested researchers here to Madison and to see what everyone's working on, and to discuss how we can move the field forward. So I think a lot of those interactions are just are really important. Especially because we are all coming from different policy environments, different historical background contexts in terms of, you know, what got researchers here to begin with. So it's really imperative, I think, that we come together at this point as the field's evolving to discuss our research. So I'm very much looking forward to that.
Hmm. You know, I'm wondering, Sylvia, how could bits of data become so predictive of life outcomes? And what are the risks? Can we read into that too much?
Yeah, I think there's been, for me, they are surprisingly predictive, to be honest. So I you know, when I first got into this field, I was, you know, skeptical, like healthy, you know, skepticism. And the more I worked with the data, the more I was amazed at how predicted it was and how it was predictive above and beyond more traditional measures we had in the social sciences. And that's where I think that really the value added comes in, because it is something different that is allowing us to move our knowledge forward. In terms of misinterpretation, I want to go back to a point that Jason made, that while it is highly predictive, I feel like we are, this genetic markers, we are still in our infancy in understanding the channels through which they operate. Clearly, when we talk about more social outcomes and even some diseases, it's, you know, the way, the pathways in which this genetic predict disease or, you know, say education, it's much more, it's very social, and it's kind of not only biological. And I think that's a very normal misconception that the public has, that just because it's genetic, it's biological. And what we as a field have found is that, yes, these genetic markers are predictive, but they are far from being only, they're far from working only through biological pathways. And I think understanding this and really underlying this lesson is very important for how we think about it and what kind of conclusions we can and can't take from this very predictive markers.
And you start to wonder then, you know, was what you experienced a random coincidence, or whether your success was something authentic to you, or was it a lucky break, or was it your DNA? Mm-hmm. And it starts, you know, Jason, to bring up so many questions about the human experience, but and also who we are inside with our genes.
You're exactly right. Everyone has those both family stories about, you know, uncles or aunts that did something a certain way or was a highly trained musician and passing that down in their families as a partial explanation for your own generations or, you know, or your own siblings' successes or failures. So it does both go along with some of the folk tales that we have in our family, but also breaks from them. I mean, very importantly, to go back to some of the things we talked about before, this is very much nature and nurture and not deterministic, as Sylvia was just describing. If there's no nature without nurture and there's no nurture without nature in these cases, and we're building data sets on each of those sides and methods from each of those sides to combine what we can learn from both and how they interact with one another. That's what's so unique. You know, you're even individuals who are identical twins experience very different environments as they grow older. And so it's both nature and the nurture that they face.
Well, Jason, Lauren, and Sylvia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Kate.
Thank you. This was great. Thank you.
That is Sylvia Elena Barcelos, Lauren Schmitz, and Jason Fletcher. They're on the faculty of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. The conference called Advances in Social Genomics opens today at UW-Madison, showcasing the work of researchers from around the world in the fields of social science and genetic research, looking at how genes and people's environments interact.